mentioned, I was already pregnant at the time and teaching 6 days a week, and there was not much opportunity for travel.
Did your negotiations make it very clear that Isabella was included as part of the...
Yeah, it was, as one might say, crystal clear.
Did you discuss what sort of research you'd be doing at NRL?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what were the discussions like?
Yes, well, I'm sure that they concerned the point that we had plans for enhancing the techniques of structure research by gas electron diffraction, and that we would need to build an apparatus for this, and also pursue the theoretical aspects. And this was all quite acceptable. In fact, one of the things that I found extremely attractive about NRL at the time is that they had a first-rate machine shop, which was at peak capacity in a sense because of all the work that they'd done during the war with excellent machinists. And I knew that they could really build the kind of an apparatus that I wanted. That made me feel very good.
They also had a good vacuum tube shop, as they called it at the time.
Yeah.
And helped us design our circuits and so forth for the very accurate. I mean, we did very well in measuring.
Yeah, well, I think we had to do a measure of voltage. Set up the current
and
beam and
yes,
very well controlled current.
Very well controlled currents and the measuring the vacuum.
Focusing on the beam.
And the high vacuum, all that sort of thing.
Could you tell us something about those shop facilities, personnel?
Well, the people in the machine shop were sort of vague to me because you would operate through their foreman, and although you could come and talk to them a little bit, it was almost a fleeting visit. You didn't get to really know them very well. At the time, there was a commander, Navy commander, who later became the commanding officer here at the lab. His name was Brad Bennett, who took a personal interest in seeing to it that that apparatus would get made, and made personally. It's a great thing.
In fact, it was he who suggested make two. And that was very convenient because when I was putting together the apparatus, there was two of each piece. If one had a small leak in it, we had to test everything for their vacuum abilities and so forth, or didn't quite fit, the other one did, and so we had one apparatus running much faster than
we... Much sooner than it would have otherwise if we had to wait for the little...
A little corks to be...
straightened out. Mm-hmm. So there was great support right up to the man who was in charge of the machine shop. Public Works is actually what he was in charge of, and machine shops came under his purview. And he was extremely helpful. The people in the shops that we mentioned were very talented. And we got the apparatus put together in record time.
How long was that?
Well, I think that everything, the drawings and everything else were developed over, and the machining over a period of about a year, and that was great.
We were already publishing papers in 48, I think.
In 48. We came here in 46.
Well, I didn't come till the fall of 46.
Yes. And yeah, we were giving papers already.
And we have publications from 1948 using the instrument, and that was really record time.
That is.
Yeah. And we didn't have a large group of people working with us.
Well, we just had one man who was excellent again to help us put everything together, to the vacuum testing and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
the high voltage testing.
Developing the theory and everything else. I don't know how we had time for everything.
And a new baby.
Well, at any rate, everything was fulfilled. The atmosphere in the optics division that was created and maintained by Ed Hulbert was just quite great. Mm-hmm. He was what anybody would call an academic person, and a good researcher, excellent researcher on his own. Mm-hmm. Appreciated all kinds of things.
Did you have much contact with Hulbert?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we used to have nice friendly contacts with him. He was interested in many other things besides optics, and amongst them was marine biology, and I had a graduate degree in biology, and so we would have some very, very nice conversations about other things that were quite different from optics.
We had a
conversation in general. Very nice.
A coffee meeting every morning, informal, social, and Towsey was then head of some spectroscopy division, and Sanderson, and a good many other people who then moved over to the new building, which is an old building now, the upper atmosphere research building. We're all here on the second floor.
Atmosphere and astrophysics.
That's right, ANA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the people in the optics division were quite nice.
What was the research atmosphere like?
Oh, it was first rate. I mean, it was just what I described. It was not overly organized by any stretch of the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So it was obvious from our research program and the things that we were doing that it was not close to the bias. It was good. And if I have to say along those lines, it was just clearly stated here that the point of view was to find good people and to give them then the opportunity to do their work. And that's exactly what was happening. And it showed in the productivity of the division of the lab.
Yeah. Well, by the time we came, there was already another person here, Vern Burks, who made, he was interested in about the electron microscope and X-ray optics of various kinds, and he had made quite a reputation for himself. He retired, a number of years ago already.
Maybe 4 or 5 years.
Uh-huh. But he was one of the young people here by the time we came, and eventually, this group got broken up into three pieces when Friedman became much more interested in the upper atmosphere research and got the...
Had a whole division established.
Oh, yes. And then Vern Burks' activities remained down on the second floor, and we moved up here into all separate groups.
There was a coterie of people at the lab interested in X-ray research, including Burks. There's also a male who was in metallurgy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We did not have that much contact with him.
You could then feel free to direct your own work. You did not have someone. Did you need to get approval as you made steps along the way, or were you?
Well, it was very casual.
A lot of paper, administrative paperwork to worry about or anything
else. No, nothing to waste time.
Was there any expectation? Was there any expectation that the research you would do it would be of eventual utility to the Navy? Was that ever stated or unstated?
The work would be relevant?
At some point in time. Mm-hmm. What was the feeling of applied versus basic research?
Well, formal statements with regard to relevance really didn't come into the picture until congressmen got into the act at the end of the 60s. Everybody understood that this was a Navy laboratory, and that ultimately the the work would be directed towards Navy interests. But it was also understood that you get farther and do a better job if you can carry the work out initially in a very broad context. And so my feeling from being here is that there was always a large amount of work that had a very specific purpose and perhaps fairly short-range goals, but there was also the understanding that there were other kinds of projects that could benefit from the long-range point of view and just from the general development of fundamental science. And we had the good fortune to carry out a good deal of our work in that context. There were opportunities all along the line in our work and in other people's work that was carried out in this broad basis to make a contribution to specific Navy problems, and of course those were never overlooked. But at the same time, the atmosphere for us was not so constrained that we didn't dare take on a big problem without necessarily seeing every step to some ultimate application, but just that this was important science and that if it came through, why then its implications and applications would be very broad and very generally useful. And we appreciated that, and it was the atmosphere for the most part in which we worked.
Would you say that was characteristic of your division, optics, or was it characteristic of the lab as a whole? Do you have any feelings on that?
Well, I really can't say. I was never that deeply involved in the lab as a whole, but from what I was able to see, there was always a certain amount of work, a certain percentage of the work, that seemed to be very deeply basic and very much mm-hmm. fundamental, mm-hmm. and whose implications would have to be long range.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was certainly true of optics, though. Yes. We didn't have that close contact with very many. I mean, of course, we knew people around the laboratory,
yes.
but with the workings of the other divisions.
Yes. But at the same time, to a very large extent, it was obvious that the needs of the Navy were not lost sight of by any means, and that there were always many projects going on that had immediate application.
You suggested that the attitude, this sort of attitude towards pre-research, changed in the late 60s due to the intervention of Congress.
Well, I don't know that it was so much that the administration here attitude changed, but they were trying to adjust to outside pressures where written statements and much more
stated goals.
Paperwork had to be mm-hmm. Put in the form of objectives and implications and applications and so forth. And so there were pressures, and they would vary. And so this gave rise to a certain amount of paperwork and a lot more reviewing. Sometimes you'd feel that you were getting reviewed to death about this particular subject, you know, what you're going to do for the next 10 or 15 minutes. This had very funny, I remember one time when the pressures almost forced the lab to run only on the basis of short-range goals. And 6 months yearly projects and all that would be reviewed and so forth. And somebody was telling me, I don't remember the connection, they had been down at the Pentagon, and with the usual turnover of personnel there who were leading things. And the new gentleman there was looking at the programs and says, "How come we don't have any long-range goals?" And of course the answer was obvious. We just didn't have any for a while because they were changed to short-range goals, etc. But I think that the attitude here at the lab has really always been very fine. But there can be enough pressures from the outside that make it a little difficult to accommodate the best of all worlds for research, and at the same time appear to be obeying the rules as they're set down. But it's still quite good here. It's still fine.
Was there any effect when the change administration was split into a naval commander and a civilian? You had two people running the facility.
It was always like that. That's what we always had. We always had a Navy leader here. However, it was only into the 50s that we had a civilian research director per se. Before that, the heads of the various divisions used to get together.
There were 10 of them, I think.
Something of that. Mm. So mm-hmm. There may have been 10 of them, and they'd have their periodic meetings, and they just kind of ran the lab. And it was done very harmoniously. Mm-hmm. It was only later on that the administration became more centralized.
It was in 1949 that Holbrook became the first civilian director of research.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any...
Was it 49? So it was that early. I thought it was in the 50s, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Did you notice any change after that at all? Due to Holbrook's leadership?
Well, you see, leadership in science is not to try to lead. And Holbrook was not a person who would try to lead. Holbrook, in his actions, I was fairly low on the totem pole in those days, so any immediate interactions would be remote. However, knowing him, and watching the way subsequent directors were, they, for the most part, were just trying to do what was administratively to the advantage of the research institution per se. But this didn't result in directives and various types of interactions that changed the way the place worked at all. In fact, no, I didn't notice any influence on my research program, and I was just sorry that he was up front in some office instead of not still downstairs on the second floor where we used to have great sociability.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the extent of the change.
Even after Page became director, I think he was the second one, wasn't he, Robert Page? I don't think we felt any changes in the laboratory. It was after... when the third director came, and then by that time I think the pressures from the outside.
Page preceded Alan Berman.
No,
yes.
He did?
Yes.
Yes, in between there were several other gentlemen. There was Marsky.
Oh.
And there was this gentleman from Up Air.
Forgot.
Who went out to head up the lab in Hughes. His name escapes me for now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there were either two or three people before Page, and Page preceded Berman.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember Page best of all all of them.
Oh, he was fine.
He was a very nice,
friendly gentleman. Again, whatever he could do for the laboratory, that he was one of the really instrumental developers of radar preceding during the war.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice person. Oh, it was just very pleasant.
In that first year you were building your apparatus, had you given thought to the systems you were going to study with that? Had you already, what were you targeting for work for you?
Oh, I was publishing a lot of theoretical papers while all that was going on, so I was getting all cranked up. We had to do something else. It wasn't just a matter of apparatus. It was a matter of how you would analyze the better data that you had. And I was very much influenced by a paper that Peter Debye had written in 1941 that I read avidly while I was a graduate student. What he had in there was a type of mathematics that would be applicable if somehow or other you could do some interesting thing to the data that you obtained from experiment. Amongst the things that you had to be able to do was to transform the data that you got from real atoms into the data that you would have obtained had all the atoms had their scattering power concentrated in a point. And there were some other things that needed to be done. Well, I was very busy working out the techniques for data reduction, and also it was necessary to embellish that theory because it assumed that you had an infinite amount of data, which I was quite certain I was not going to collect. That was a classic problem. There was actually another problem about it, too. It had to be obtained very accurately against background scattering. That was another assumption in there. It turns out that in solving that problem, I saw how to do the crystal structure problem. And it was that development that actually led to the solution to the crystal structure problem. Mm-hmm. Of course, it wasn't easy going. It wasn't anything you did in 5 minutes, but there was the criterion. The first paper that Isabel and I wrote on gas electron diffraction structural work had in it a particular criterion which could be generalized to crystal structure analysis. And so that mm-hmm. made a good deal more of the program. But yes, we had many substances in mind that whose structure we were going to go after. And
if I may interrupt at this point, what we did in these early papers, and of course later ones, actually these papers are considered classic now, 48, 49, 50, was that we not only were able to establish how the atoms were related to each other in a gaseous molecule, that is, whether they were arranged tetrahedrally or triangularly or whatever, but we were also able to determine how much each one wiggled, the vibrational amplitude of each one. And you can imagine, in order to be able to do that, in addition to the theoretical work that he had done and that Debye had set up the fundamentals for, we had to be able to take the data off the photographic plates and transfer it into numbers in a very accurate fashion. And we came out very well in our measurements. And that had started a whole new era in the electron diffraction by gaseous molecules. So we had started out very simply with carbon tetrachloride, carbon dioxide, and then went on to benzene. Although these materials had been analyzed by electron diffraction previously, we got much better results along with the vibrational measurements of each atom, and then we went on to more complicated molecules after that.
Well, the first ones were just to establish the technique.
And that indeed we could get the correct vibrational motions from them.
Mm-hmm. What was your working group? The two of you were working together. Was Hauptmann working with you after 47?
Well, he came towards the end of 47, and it was just about the time when we were seeing through how to handle this gas diffraction data. It was in 47 that we saw this. There was a certain criterion that we could apply a mathematical criterion. It was called non-negativity. And it arose from the fact that what it was that attracted me in De Bry showed was that if you did all these good things to the data and you had accurate data, that a certain mathematical manipulation would give you the probability of finding interatomic distances in a molecule. And probabilities have to be non-negative. A negative probability means nothing. Zero means all one way, and plus one means all the other way, and everything in between. So it's a non-negative function. This we made great use of, Bell and me. And this worked out so well, surprisingly well, that I started to look around for other applications, and it was obvious to me that there may be an application in the crystal structure problem, because what actually represents a structure is the electron distribution around atoms that you get from X-rays. And it comes in the form of an electron density, and the greatest electron density is in the center of an atom, so that you know where your atom is if you know where the highest part of the electron density is. Now, the electron density is also a non-negative function. Negative densities don't mean anything. You either have no density or something that builds up to a positive density. And this is what the idea that stimulated it. And so it seemed rather ideal. And Herb had joined us, and he had mathematics in his background. He's primarily a mathematician. That it seemed to me that this would be a great project for us to pursue. And it was very long range, because we couldn't see any practical solution in sight when we first started it. But at the same time, we knew that if we could solve this problem, that it would have very, very broad implications. And that is the context in which I talk about not having short-range goals or immediate applications, but to know or to see that if you can do something which is worth doing, and which we also knew, made an analysis of, we knew we had enough information that the problem had a solution. In fact, it's tremendously overdetermined. It's not just borderline hairline, but it's very much overdetermined. Now, whether it was too complicated for us to solve, this we didn't know. But that it was rational to do it, and with important implications, this was obvious to us. And we had the opportunity to do that here at NRL, and this is the atmosphere that I'm talking about, that was so favorable for doing research. Mm-hmm. So that was it. We decided we were going to get into the business of the mathematics of non-negativity, and mm-hmm. the work went on.